This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to the morning run. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris.
Yes.
There's a slight flu.
Yeah, can you hear it in my voice? You can, can you?
I think we all can, but we're going to forgive you, Melissa, because
thank you.
You know, you've done such good work over the last couple of years.
Oh, that thank you
this
so
failing
much.
On your part is never, it's not going to be held against you.
I'm sorry my voice is not 100% this morning, but
no,
you
yeah,
know.
I apologize all you like, but you know, you didn't take care of yourself, and you've only yourself to blame or that you're sick. So, you know.
Way to kick me when I'm down, Sharad.
Oh, you know, Melissa, you know, in the school of hard knocks and all that,
that's
good
right.
for you.
Walk it off, walk it off.
It's called
Sharad,
tough love.
Tough love,
you know. Keep them mean. No, treat them mean, keep them keen, I think is the other.
The what now?
Treat them mean, keep them keen. And it's got to do with interpersonal relationships.
I've never heard that before.
Often, you know, a description of how best to treat somebody that you love and are attracted to. Don't let on that you love them too much, because if you do, then they'll take, they'll take
you for granted.
But the idea is that so you treat them mean. Not that you mean to be mean, but you treat them mean so that they continue to be keen.
Like, don't be so nice, la, after people take you for granted, is it?
That's right. But it doesn't, okay. When the way you say it, it doesn't rhyme.
Well, it's more Malaysian the way I say it.
Yeah, but then, well, that's not saying very much, is it?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, let's just keep it the rhyme and couplet that it is. Okay, we have a very exciting lineup this morning for you. Because, you know, we go all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. On The Breakfast Grill, which is our flagship show, and it, you know, starts just after the 8 o'clock news, we have Anusha Devaraja. She's CEO of AIA Berhad, and she speaks to Julian Ng. Mm. So I guess it's a discussion on insurance.
They're definitely interesting because, you know, the insurance industry is going through a liberalization phase. So I think we want to find out a little bit more about how AIA is dealing with the liberalization, as well as, you know, when we talk, the theme for 2016, I think, has largely been the disruption of fintech to the banking industry. And the insurance industry is not spared either from this digital revolution. So let's find out how AIA has been dealing with that.
Okay. And for you in the house who haven't not insured, let me tell you how important it is. This year alone, I ended up in hospital. And if not for the fact that I'm insured, in this instance through BFM, but, you know, it really saved me a penny or two.
You know, Sharad, to be completely honest with you, yes, the rate of penetration of insurance in Malaysia is still quite low. So a lot of people are still uninsured. But there's also the problem of being underinsured. So even if you have insurance, you may not have enough protection that you may require.
Yeah. And, that's an ongoing question also about the kind of profits that the insurance industry makes, the kind of limits they put on things like how much your premiums are depending on, you know, pre-existing conditions or your
also,
lifestyle.
But also, you know, the person's ability to pay. So sometimes you know insurance is important, but you opt for the cheapest possible coverage and therefore you're underinsured.
Yeah, you're thinking that maybe that's all that
that's
is
all you need, yeah.
So you need to...
And all you can afford, to be quite frank, you know.
Yeah, I guess. Okay, after that exciting grill, we're going to be coming to the current affairs segment where we're going to be looking at the PISA results, so the Program for International Student Assessment that's run by the OECD. Now, we were meant to air this yesterday, but because our grill on PTPTN was extended, we left it to today. So so there you can have, there is a discussion. There was a bit of a controversy and had to do with the fact that the Malaysian scores weren't officially released by the OECD. They're not part of the list of many countries that were represented. And that has to do with the fact that I think the schools in which the samples were taken from had shifted. There were too many changes. And so the OECD's survey unit that conducts it decided that perhaps that compromised the results. But there were scores, and students were tested, and on that basis, we can still draw some conclusions.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, if you read, I think the latest issue of The Economist has a discussion of PISA, because many countries in the kind of OECD zone also, you know, take this. In fact, it's over 50 countries.
What was the discussion about?
Well, it was a discussion about how, like Malaysia, it seems like this is not particularly unique response. There's a lot of hand-wringing that goes on, or, you know, questioning PISA results and such. But The Economist, its position was that one needed to, you know, to just look at what PISA is teaching us about the question of teaching and student performances. So they highlighted the role of teachers and good quality teachers. They looked at some very interesting cross-country results with regard to migrants. So, you know, scores of migrant children or children of migrants did not depend on the country they came from, not the country of origin,
right,
but the country they landed in. So it really was about the schooling system. There was apparently a kind of snarky response in Europe to some of the results. Because we know the Singaporeans were on the top of the PISA rankings. And it says, well, you know, maybe we should all learn to eat with chopsticks.
Ooh.
And that kind of slightly snarky, slightly racist, you know, response, you know, the Economist said, was, you know, inadequate. I mean, it's like, you know, what you really ought to be doing is saying, okay, and in fact, the arguments are not, the PISA results don't make an argument for nature, meaning that certain populations of the world are, you know, endowed genetically or whatever it is. That's not the argument they're making. The argument is, in fact, for environmental factors.
Better schooling.
Yeah, better schooling. In fact, they also said that the only in countries where say infrastructure is very poor, more investment in terms of money bears better results. Otherwise, you hit a point where you can throw money at the problem, right, and it doesn't solve anything. It doesn't push your grades up. So a whole host of very interesting discussion points that come out of the PISA survey. So if you have access to The Economist, you could read that. It's actually an editorial that they put out along with, I think, a discussion of the new way business is going to be done in Trump's America, and how dangerous it could be. In fact, they're very, very down on Donald Trump's many moves of late, including him having that discussion with techie kings.
Yeah. The Silicon Valley event. That's right. Okay, so that was PISA as the topic for
that's
Current Affairs.
Current Affairs, after the 8:30 news. Now, okay, the show today is The Property Show. And Melissa, you join Azur Rahman, who's the regular host of the show, to do a roundup of the most important property news for the month of December.
Mm. Okay, and also not just the month of December, but also a bit of a look back to the year 2016, most important property news. We've picked up on certain themes, again, MRT and the impact it has on property prices and land prices. MRT starts today, so that's, I guess, also something that we've been looking at throughout the year. Affordable housing remains on the agenda, of course, and also on the commercial retail space, when we talk about shopping malls, there's been such a glut, and I think both tenants, shoppers, and mall operators are suffering.
You know, when I was looking for a property some time ago, I did consider the fact that the line ran, you know, close to certain properties I was looking at.
Yeah.
I think for sure people like me, you know, who don't drive and who think that the future is, you know, becoming, you know, kind of thoroughgoing pedestrian, you know, this is a real boon.
Right.
Though I'm surprised by some of the front page headlines on the LRT. It's like
the MRT.
The MRT. It's like, you know, we have reached some point of modernity because we have a new train in town. I mean, it's just shocking.
Yeah, well, you know, it I guess increased public transport is what most urban denizens want. But I have to say, Shira, this is just the first phase. I have to say, I'm looking forward to the second phase as well, because we're talking about more connectivity in places in Kajang and Semenye. So that allows people to live in the outskirts of KL and not need to drive into the city centre to work.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, Kajang and Semenye are no longer the outskirts. I think it's Nilai 3.
Yeah.
That's the outskirts. That's true. But, you know, look at the Straits Times this morning. On track to develop status. Prime Minister announced 1 month of free. Okay, never mind about that.
That's not really about modernity.
One of the MRT Sungai Buloh Kajang line today will take Malaysia one step closer to becoming a first world nation. I mean, come on. Honestly, you know.
I think
another train. This is like, well, you know, like we have three extra buses or a fleet of buses. So what, are we closer to becoming a first world nation because we have buses?
Well, isn't that
it's a train line, for goodness sakes, just a transport.
I understand. I think NSD was trying to play on the the right track. You know, they wanted to play with the pun.
There is this kind of old-fashioned thing that maybe made sense in the 60s.
You don't agree that proper infrastructure is the mark of a developed nation?
Yes, but every instance of building, you know, a bus stop does not take us closer to becoming a first world nation.
I mean, maybe not as granular as that.
In the 60s,
but it's a transport plan.
Look,
it's a transport plan.
In the 60s, you know, we and you can see that we put these things on our currency, our dollar bills, right? Because suddenly, you know, and this is true most of the 20th century. You know, a Sputnik or a cable car, whatever it is,
or a giant international airport, whatever,
and all of them signal that we're on our way to modernity. But at some point, you have to stop. Celebrating every, you know, bus stop that is built. I mean, really, honestly, that's how I feel. I mean, but it's, you know, it's a Friday morning and, you know, let's keep it light.
And cheerful.
Cheerful.
Heading to the weekend.
Let's look at the news. Facebook apparently is finally helping you combat the spread of fake news and the shaping of a mind by fake news. Because some of the most famous fake news this year. Melissa, can you think of anything? I think of Pope Francis endorsing Donald Trump. Why would a man committed to peace and love, you know, endorse? So I would have thought, if I read that, I would say, well, hold on, this sounds suspicious. But of course, a lot of people don't, and they go on and believe and consume this news. Because maybe, you know, the Pope has a dark side. Who knows? And, you know, he decided to, you know, support Donald Trump. I think that, in fact, so what's happening is...
How is Facebook doing
this? Okay, so Facebook is working with fact-checking outlets to label and flag possible disputed or fake stories. So I think they're allowing for the fact that a story maybe is in a gray zone as well. And so there you have it, right? So that's going.
So they're outsourcing this, you say, to a fact-checking company?
They are working with, I believe, multiple fact-checking outlets. To on stories. Also in the news, a white supremacist convicted of killing nine African-American worshippers in a church in South Carolina has been found guilty. He faces the death penalty. This is a 22-year-old who pretended to be, you know, interested in Bible study class. He sits with the other congregants and then he opens fire on them.
Dylan Roof, his name.
Yeah, Dylan Roof. Also in the news, the White House is pointing finger at President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, as being directly involved in the hacking operation that, some people say, interfered with the U.S. election results. The White House, I believe, on the side of, as it were, because they're Democrats. But what's interesting is the Republican response. Did you watch that interview that Trevor Noah on The Daily Show did with Obama? Because they talk about this, and Obama says he can't believe that the email issue became so big when, in fact, what underscored it all the way was Russia's involvement. And, you know, and he pointed out that Donald Trump, who is the POTUS, the president-elect of the United States, is, you know, actively called on the Russians to hack U.S., Hillary's accounts to, as it were, find out the truth. So that maybe will be a discussion until, well, Donald Trump comes to power.
Isn't and there going all to be an investigation on this? I believe the FBI has said that they
Yeah, they
going
have.
To...
They have already had the investigation. The issue is the Republicans, for very self-interested reasons, say that this is not such an important issue. So they're downplaying it, obviously, for the legitimacy of the Donald Trump era. Like I said, Melissa, you know, and I said this yesterday, and you kept saying, no, it's just 4 years. It's going to be 8 years. 8 years of Donald Trump. You
well,
know?
Let's not assume any longer that we absolutely have to. Okay. 4 years is what he gets right now.
read The Economist, the front page. I believe the latest issue is of Donald Trump there. King Donald, they call him in The Economist.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and all these sort of the petitionary culture that's going to develop around it, because Donald is making him, not the institutions, making his person the conduit for things to move in America. So that's very third world, including the fact that he included all his children at that meeting in Silicon Valley. So it's all a family affair. Mm. Oh, I wonder what he's going to give Ivanka. No, Ivanka is not his...
That's his ex-wife. It's Ivana.
No. Ivanka is his daughter.
Daughter. I'm sorry,
and Melania is his... His wife.
His wife, that's right.
Does sound like a disease. Okay. North Korea also been taken off YouTube. So you can't get North Korean state
Has
television.
Has it always been on YouTube?
Apparently it was on YouTube. Now it's been taken off. So boo-hoo to you if you didn't weren't watching North Korean news until now.
Man,
now
I should have subscribed when I had the chance.
Now you can't. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. The morning run continues on track. On track.
There's a play on the NST headline.
No, it's actually a play on the track that we've just played, which is a Memphis train. Oh, my goodness. Yet
because
another reference.
MRC
by Buddy Miles. interesting, a fun factoid. Buddy Miles is a singing drummer. He used to drum for Jimi Hendrix as part of the Band of Gypsies.
Oh,
it's actually called the Band of Gypsies rather than a Band of Gypsies, which,
would
be a reference to the Romani people of Europe. So
you don't hear of that many singing drummers. So yeah, good.
But singing gypsies, you do actually.
Okay.
Singing gypsies.
Sure,
the
why
movies
not?
Are full of them. Okay, that was Melissa Idris, and I'm sure I'd question. Melissa Idris has a little bit of the touch of the flu.
Just a touch under the weather.
The touch of the flu. Okay, so it is.
I've spread to everyone in the studio.
In part of the season of giving, Melissa Idris has decided to infect us all. Okay, now, but because we
I'm
will
just
use
generous
the,
p- that way.
The power of Panadol to stop the infections dead in their tracks. We're back to tracks.
I love the word.
Okay, let's talk about gifts. It is a season of giving, and in fact, we come through so many seasons of giving. I mean, Malaysia has some, I think, of countries around the world, the most number of public holidays, and of course, religiously based public holidays
at
that.
But would you call it the season of giving for the rest, for others, for Sri Raya and Chinese New Year?
Yeah, Sri Raya, you give Seruling and
Serunding.
Serunding and Rendang. Chinese, you give ang pao?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, it is the season.
Deepavali, idli and thosai. So, you know, we give all that fruitcake at Christmas.
Seems to be about food.
it's a bit food, but there's also gifts. And of course, associated with Christmas is the iconic Christmas tree and the presents below it. So even in this office, we play Secret Santa.
Yep.
And gift giving is part of it. But there are some thoughts that people have. And every year, I guess, people kind of meditate on the question of gifts and what gift giving is in contemporary society.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, again, as you said, the season of Secret Santa, right? So when you pick a name, you are Secret Santa to someone you don't really know that well, or, you know, just an acquaintance, not super close. Often when it comes to gift giving, we put a lot of thought into individualizing each gift. What would this person want? What would Sherrod Kutin enjoy most? Oh, I didn't give it away. You're not my secret. I'm not your secret Santa.
I wish you were, because you are very thoughtful, a thoughtful gift giver.
Apparently, Sherrod Kutin, the
I'm
thought
not.
Doesn't matter.
Oh.
Apparently, according to new research now, the thought just doesn't count anymore. This is very counterintuitive to what we know, because often we think about, oh, what does this person would most enjoy, and that's, and we get pleasure, and we think that that gives the receiver pleasure, but apparently it's not, because our motivations in picking a gift are completely different from the receiver's motivations for wanting the gift.
Okay, let's just put it this way.
Break it down.
Well, you know, watch a child and a gift, and I think you'll get to the heart of the human condition. Children seize the gift, rip off the beautifully and carefully put together wrapping, and get straight to the present. At which point, when they see the present, they decide it's either a thumbs down box or the thumbs up box.
You
and
can kids, see it.
And kids, yeah, and they see it, they don't hide it. And then as adults, as they grow up, they learn to hide their true feelings. So in their minds, they have a out box, and then they have a let's keep this box. I think that's true of all of us. So yes, they don't care how beautifully you've wrapped the present.
True.
I mean, and that's just the start of the very kind of primordial feelings that bubble up every time somebody gets a gift.
Well, let's kind of break it down. There's an article in the New York Times that talks about how the perfect gift is actually the one that the recipient has asked for. So often when we think about, you know, gift giving, we're thinking about, oh, I want to surprise them, something that they didn't think of, or I want something that has a big reveal. So when they open it up, it's spectacular and there's drama in the reveal. Often, more often than not, that's not the case. It's often something very simple and something that the recipient can use. I'll give you an example. The best gift I've ever received was a label maker. I love my label maker.
Okay.
I love it.
And that's what you wanted? I mean, you came to the season saying, I wish somebody gives me a label maker.
Well,
because it's not something you can, you know, afford yourself.
It's actually quite expensive. Label makers are, the good kinds are quite expensive.
Really?
Yeah, but I have to say though.
Good label makers. So
you
want your jars.
Yeah,
so you want your labels not to look like they were manufactured in Kajang.
Like handwritten label. No, not like the sticker kind.
Sumaibulo.
Okay, but what I'm saying is that if you think about, you know, a label maker, it's always like, oh, label maker, you want to give somebody stationery? What? That's not dramatic. That's not, you know, it doesn't have flair when someone opens the gift.
So,
but it's often what the recipient wants.
Okay, so in my left hand, in my right hand, there's the label maker that you've always wanted. And in my right hand, a smaller gift, a 15-carat diamond ring. Now, which one would you go for, Melissa Idris? Which would have the big reveal?
Well, that's not quite the same fair value, shall we just say, Sharad Kitten. But
so you're torn between the label maker and the 15-carat diamond ring?
Let's just say, often when you think about giving someone something, you know, you want something, you assume something pretty, something ornamental. You know what the researchers here at the New York Times have found? That, in fact, it's the utility received out of a gift that makes it more valuable to the recipient. Will I actually get any use out of this? And that is what makes the gift valuable.
Yeah, and
something to think about,
yeah,
Secret Santa.
When I think about, 15-carat diamond ring, I know it can cut through glass. There's so much utility in there, and you know, okay.
If you're thinking about diamonds, I wish you were my Secret Santa.
Yeah, no, we actually have a cap in this country, right? In this country, in BFM, which is the country, I guess. we can't spend less than 5 ringgit, not more than 30 ringgit, I believe.
What about regifting? So if you have something at home, so even though, you know, you don't spend anything, would you consider giving that as your Secret Santa gift?
You know, I actually, I want to just mention this. I played a game years ago. This was when I was kind of attached to a university in the Philippines. And we played a game where you got your gift, right? So you sat in a circle. And the person next to you, when they picked up their gift, could, if they didn't like their gift, take yours.
Wow.
So they could take any of the gifts that had already been delivered.
Of the person who
gave. Yeah, so it's like, okay, well, oh, I like your label maker. I'm going to take that and swap it around. It was called Mini Santa or something. It was really good because it really create some drama and excitement, I think, when you see how people, because you might be really excited by your gift, but then you know it could be taken away anytime, so it becomes really precious to you. And often, if it's a really
it's
good
fear of loss,
so it does sort of sour and make a little more bitter the season, but hey, that's real life, isn't it? I think it is.
So just a tip for gift buying, when you're going out for Christmas shopping or trying to buy something for a Secret Santa, don't over individuate your gifts. Don't put too much thought into it. Just buy something simple, something that would be of good use to them.
Yeah, because the researchers at the New York Times in their white suits know better than the weight of history.
I don't know.
I'm looking at Lynn Mark now, who's poised to read the news any moment now. And if she's my secret Santa, I want to tell her that there are many things that are very expensive that I would really like.
15 carat diamonds.
Okay, but first, her gift for the day, the first bulletin, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the morning run continues, and that was Absolute Beginners by The Jam. I'm sure I'd continue with me, Melissa Idris. It's now 6:41, and it's the 16th of December. Shout out to my cousin. Oh, well, she doesn't live in this country. But anyway, it's her birthday.
Oh, it's her birthday. Happy birthday, Shira Kutan's cousin.
Happy birthday to you, Nara. Okay. Antiquities. So this is a story of an 18th century Chinese imperial seal that has been sold for a record 21 million euros, okay, which is about $22 million or £18 million, and you know, times depending on where the Malaysian ringgit is to the US dollar, it's either, you know, close to 100 million or what, something like that. Okay, it's because 4.4 is it to the US dollar today, yesterday. So that's about 90 million ringgit. Now, this is more than 20 times its estimated price. Why it's interesting, Melissa, is that, and this just happened, by the way, it's sold to an unnamed Chinese collector. And I've been reading a little bit about Chinese billionaires of late. One of them who appears in a story in The New Yorker, because he's building museums and he's collecting art and he's paying extraordinary prices for modern and contemporary artworks around the world to put in his museums. But he's also buying, and part of that discussion that the Chinese rich are having, along with the government of China, about antiquities stolen during those various periods of warfare in China, especially the period in which China was sacked by European or Western powers. And there are hundreds, thousands of, treasures that were taken from the imperial courts of China and taken to Western countries and then become either part of their museums or part of private collections.
But it's not just China, is it, Sherrod? Because, you know, I mean, think about stolen antiquities from Egypt, from the Middle East.
Absolutely. And so the whole question, India, for instance, you know, a major diamond is in the British crown, right? The Koh I Noor, right? So when you think about that, all kinds of really interesting and tricky questions arise. Do the countries from which they were stolen, I use air quotes here, have a right to demand that these objects are returned to them? Now, that's one route. You can say demand that. And it's happened sometimes with individuals, right? If you think of the Hottentot Venus, right, who was an actual person. She was a South African, a woman who was kind of like became part of a circus in Europe. And when she died, her body was mummified and put up for display. So, you know, her community demanded that she be returned and given a proper burial.
Her community meaning?
The people who are the Hottentots is the name of a community, right?
I see. Okay. So, is it an indigenous tribe?
That's right. I mean, the innate natives. I mean, they're just people from South Africa. And so, but this is slightly different, right? And so some of the Chinese rich, including this particular billionaire who I was reading about, his whole attitude is, look, it doesn't matter. You know, we don't have to make such claims. All we need to do is buy them back. And they're using their financial heft to repurchase or to have, as it were, repatriated using market mechanisms, things that are considered important to Chinese history. So this is an imperial seal that was used by Emperor Qinlong. He was one of the longest-serving Chinese emperors. And so, of course, it has, you know, historic value for Chinese collectors and the Chinese state as well. And I just wonder about this, because there's also this whole question of where did these imperial powers get their treasures from?
Right.
Weren't they also robbing and pillaging smaller empires and kingdoms?
Well, maybe. That's a good point.
Yeah, you know, so there's this endless chain of demands. I mean, if you think about land, you know, I'm sure, you know, there are a lot of native peoples, and meaning tribal peoples, who say, well, their land was stolen. And we see the troubles happening now in Kelantan over Kashmir land. You know, the native peoples there, the Temiya people, are constantly having, you know, other interests encroach on their land, steal it from them, land that they've always considered their ancestral domain, right? So,
you know, when I was on my sabbatical, Sharad, I was in Italy recently. When I was on sabbatical, I was in Italy, and I was in this place. It was called Volterra, and it was really quite interesting because apparently newest research had showed that there were I don't know what you call it, like a what they call the gladiator ring,
the amphitheater.
Thank you. They had found a scan of an amphitheater. Apparently, there was a farmer who wanted to build a ditch, and to do that in Italy you have to get a surveyor because of the land. Now, whatever you find in your land underground belongs to the Italian government. So when they found this, and everyone got really excited because apparently it was more well preserved, it's thought to be more well preserved according to scans than the Colosseum. So people really excited to dig this up, and perhaps this could be the next big thing that Italy can offer in terms of, you know, the heyday of what was Rome, wasn't it? But the Italian government didn't have money to purchase that land because, you know, again, it belongs to the Italian government, but they have to pay the woman who owns the land.
They should pay her compensation.
And they don't have money. As you know, the Italian government's in a bit of a disarray at the moment. So it's just sitting there in the ground, and everyone who can see the scans are really excited to dig it up, but you can't because it owned, you know, this is deadlock with the Italian government.
Yeah. There are also some, you know, practical side to this whole story of antiquities. I think of, you know, the instance where I think the children of our former deputy prime minister, Dr. Ismail, gave his papers
to
Singapore, right? To an institution in Singapore. And because, you know, and I don't know what the official reasons were, but I imagine because they expected that they would be preserved better by these institutions. Maybe they're more professional, or, you know, and such. And I think that's also that story, right? You think of all those Egyptian antiquities, you know, in the British Museum. Is the British Museum better, you know, place to look after Egyptian antiquities,
right,
than Egyptian institutions, you know? And is that the way the chips fall in the story? Or should we be looking at shared this sharing of this heritage? Because it's, in fact, in some ways, neither just Egyptian nor British, but, you know, something to do with global heritage. I mean, it's heritage for all of us.
That's interesting. So you're saying it doesn't have to remain in the country of origin. So let's just say, how would you feel if, say, the Malaysian constitution, the very first Malaysian flag, was in Britain? Would you be okay with that?
Well, you know, I every time the discussion about patriotism comes up again, I always...
Oh, okay. I wasn't thinking about it in patriotic terms, but rather antiquities.
I think that...
Hamtuas Keris, if... You know, if that's not controversial.
He's mythological, isn't
okay,
he?
Okay, let's go with the Perak Man, for instance,
okay,
right? On the historical side.
Yeah, if there were real artifacts, I think I would like to believe that it's best to distribute these antiquities across the world. And, you know, if they're close to their location, all the better, right? So, you know, Lembah Bujang and the antiquities that are found there should be in Kedah or in the areas around Lembah Bujang. I think that's the best place to put them, just because you have a sense of the landscape. But that's not the only consideration. I think the considerations could be also whether there are facilities and then you have access to scientists and historians and people to do the research around this. Because it's not just an object that sits in a glass case. It's part of historical research. So I wouldn't feel... You know, if there were good reasons for it to be in another place, so be it. I personally don't think. I think a lot of what drives this is patriotism, this nationalistic zeal. And so our artifacts must be brought back to our country because they belong to us. I think that is the syntax, that is the language that is used. I don't think necessarily that's always the most intellectually generous and expansive way to think about the things. But I can see why there are these strong feelings, especially if you feel that things were stolen during a time of national weakness. So you think of, you know...
Now that we're strong, we want it back.
Yeah, so okay. China, you know, when it was, you know, factionalized, with all these warlords, when it was weakened and therefore was allowed itself to be overtaken by Western interests and carved out. So they feel that pain because that's the story they keep telling themselves, and they want some sort of way of achieving closure. And so the story of antiquities continues, I think, and we'll see more stories like this, I think, coming from China, as China's rich. And I think it's very interesting. China's rich are leading the charge to get China's antiquities back.
Well, you know, the fact that for the imperial seal, it was the person paid more than 20 times the estimated auction price. So clearly they can afford it.
And,
you know,
there was a bidding war. Apparently there was a heated bidding war for that.
There you go.
Okay, we're going to be coming up to the news at 7 o'clock. But here's A Brick House by the Commodores, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.